Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And so good to have you back again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, energy. Today, we're going to get right to our guest, William Kassebaum. He's president, CEO of Stellar Wind Bioenergy. And on the surface, you might think that Stellar Wind Bioenergy might be another treatment of wind power on this program, but no. As a matter of fact, Kassebaum and his organization is involved with LG. Now, all the things, the negatives that you've heard about the impossibility of LG on this program and other places, he has an answer for. He's got a remarkable new patented way of delivering great amounts of oil for us, energy for us from algae. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. And of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, and visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And right now, though, let's get on to William Kassebaum, dial him up, and see what he has to say for us.
Stand by.
Well, you've heard us speak about LG occasionally on this program, and of course, there's a lot of hope for LG, but some of the negatives have been expressed by people that have been on this program, too, about the large areas that are needed to grow LG, and that it wasn't going to be any kind of technology that comes by anytime soon. Well, I happened to run into a guy by the name of William Kassebaum when I was at the IEEE Energy in Motion conference in Austin last week, and he's doing some pretty remarkable things with LG, and so I wanted to get him on the line to tell us all about it. Welcome to the program, Will.
Thank you, Colonel Mason. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, now bring us up to date. Now, you're doing some things with LG. You say it's considered one of the best alternatives to generating fuels. A full-scale LG plant, you're saying, can produce 500,000 barrels of LG per year. But what is a full-scale LG plant? This has been a question that recurs on this program all the time. Can you explain it to us?
Well, a full-scale algae plant, the way we've considered it, would be rather large. It would be upwards of 2,000 acres mm-hmm. of algae production, and that the output of such a plant could be around 500,000 barrels of algae oil and quite a number of other products made from the biomass.
2,000 acres. Now, this is the reason that a lot of people that are skeptical about LG have said that it isn't going to work, because 2,000 acres is an expensive piece of territory to set aside for the growing of algae, and that algae takes time to grow and harvest and reharvest and that sort of thing. But you say that you're solving these problems. Is that right?
Right, and further, I would say that algae in many ways is so much more productive than the other crops that we're using for energy these days, that it is eminently preferable. One of the nice things about algae, too, is it doesn't necessarily have to be agricultural land. There are all kinds of land, for instance, in the Midwest that might have been coal land, land that is not productive for one reason or other from an agricultural perspective, but it's relatively mm-hmm. flat, and yeah. those areas can be used to grow algae. And of course, we have all kinds of land around the country that isn't agricultural land that could potentially be a great place to grow algae.
So if you're going to put in one of these algae plants, you're talking about leasing the land from somebody then and putting in, what, shallow pools or something, or what's this going to look like?
Well, what we call them, we've been sort of joking about what the right name is. Our system is a high-capacity system, so it is a It is a set of what are technically called bioreactors, but they are, we would call it like an algae vineyard. So our algae farm will be covered with this vineyard of reactors that essentially spread the light out across all the algae so that it can grow at a very high density and capacity.
Okay, and you can only grow this algae at certain times of the year. I mean, I understand you're building a plant in the Midwest somewhere, and I hope you can explain a little bit about that to us. But you can't grow it in the wintertime, can you?
Well, you have to keep it within a certain temperature range, and that is absolutely true. Different strains and species of algae like different temperatures. Some of them are happier up in, say, the 90s, but some of the most promising strains really like it more like around what we like it, around 72 degrees Fahrenheit, so plus or minus 5 degrees. And so it's important to keep it right in that temperature range. So in the summer, actually, one of the harder problems is keeping it cool, believe it or not. In the Midwest, it's very temperate, and for those folks who may be heating and cooling people, you've probably heard the term wet bulb temperature. In other words, that means if we've got enough water, in Indiana, for instance, we can keep the temperature under 78 degrees any time during the year. In the winter, though, you're right. Things are going to get cold, so we have to be able to keep the algae warm enough that it's within that growing temperature range. And that is one reason why placing algae around where fossil fuel plants are is also an encouraging thing to do, because there's also always a lot of waste heat, and that waste heat can be used to keep the algae farm warm as well.
Well, I don't think you'll get any argument from people about algae being a lot better source than using corn feed and stuff that we'd ordinarily use for food. Certainly, we may as well use algae. But are you suggesting then that maybe some of the algae farms would do well near nuclear power plants that use water for cooling and therefore have a warm water supply? Is that an angle?
Well, certainly, any place you have warm water, you can certainly use that waste heat to keep things warm. But the other part of it is you do need the CO2. The algae, if we remember our basic biology, CO2 plus water and sunlight makes sugar using chlorophyll. So that's your biology lesson for today. So the CO2 has to be present in enough quantity that the algae can do that conversion efficiently. There's great concern about what CO2 may be doing to our environment, but in nature right now there's only about 380 parts per million in the atmosphere. Many of us have had the experience of taking a nice plant home from the store, maybe. It's lush and gorgeous when we take it home, and then it just doesn't like it as well when we get home. We water it and we take care of it. Many times that's because that plant has been grown in a greenhouse with 5% CO2. And so it's taking it home means it doesn't have very much CO2 with which to grow really, really well. Same for our algae. If we have a source of concentrated CO2, we can get the algae growing a lot faster than it would grow otherwise.
I think this is really fascinating, because we've done so many stories on this program about global warming and getting rid of the CO2, and you're suggesting, and others too, that solving our energy supply by growing algae we're going to be needing the CO2. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. It's essentially a resource. If it's damaging the planet or not, it's somewhat controversial, but nonetheless, it is a resource, and we can use it. And where it's concentrated will be the easiest places to get it. And all around industrial activity, around power generation, around even ethanol plants, which a third of their production is CO2, there's great opportunity to capture it and turn it into algae. And a good bit of what we make from the algae are a fossil fuel. So in a way, you could imagine that we're recycling it to get a lot more out of it.
And you've got a certain method that you're using. You call it aseptic monocultural growth, that you're patenting. Tell us why this is different from any other algae sources that are out there.
Well, most of the algae companies, there are some that are working in bioreactors, but many are working in what are called open ponds. Mm-hmm. And so most of us have heard about those. The problem you have with an open pond is that you grow whatever grows in that area. The algae is in the wind, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Here in Indiana, you put a glass of water on your windowsill and you'll be growing algae in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
It grows in the dog dish is out on the porch, we get it full of algae.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens in natural ponds. We grow whatever grows, the local flora and fauna, bacteria, mold, algae, it all gets meshed up together into the same mess. In one of our reactors, we can keep it aseptic and monocultural. And what we mean is we only grow the one thing we want to grow and nothing else. We can keep it, every segment of our reactor farm can be just growing that one thing. Eventually, over 6 to 9 months, one of the reactors may become contaminated. But then we can just flush that one segment and clean it and keep going. If you have a large pond that gets infected, which normally they do within weeks, then you may lose the entire pond and have to start over, which would pretty much wipe out your productivity. So that's one reason why this approach is so much better than the open pond method.
Well, now, are you telling me that 2,000 acres are going to be enclosed and not be an open pond, but control it somehow? How are you doing that?
Well, there are a number of designs we're working on, but yes, that's essentially right. During the winter, you will have to keep a blanket of warm air near the ground around these algae reactors. But honestly, in the summer, you don't want that. You would much rather have it open to the environment for cooling. So we will be working very hard to minimalize any kind of covering that we may have, just to keep that blanket of warm air near the ground. And as in engineering lingo, we reduce the amount of surface area available to cooling.
Now, let me get this straight. You're planning to put in a facility in Indiana that has pretty hot summers and certainly has very cold winters that will produce algae on 2,000 acres year-around. Is that what we're doing?
That's correct.
That's pretty remarkable, William. I really must say I'm trying to envision this. And I understand it's pretty good stuff, too, the algae that you're producing. It's high-end test fuels for the U.S. military and general aviation and jet fuels. Tell us about those.
Well, it's very interesting, and this is one of the very exciting parts of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
As many of us may know, and I'll start by saying a little bit about general aviation fuel. General aviation fuels for small aircraft are the last leaded fuels on the market. 100 low lead is one of the last, and I think it has about 2 ounces of lead,
mm-hmm.
a fair amount in each gallon. It is one of the biggest sources of lead pollution across the country, and certainly centered around the general aviation busy Midwest. That market is around 280 million gallons a year. So this is a fuel, honestly, the EPA would badly like to ban,
mm-hmm.
make go away. But pilots, of course, need this fuel and can't use regular motor gas because it has ethanol and it just doesn't have the octane rating required for these small airplanes. Using our algae, we can produce a fuel that becomes a 100% renewable, sustainable replacement fuel that has a number of, superior characteristics to what you'd find in 100LL, including an increase in range of about 15%, a 20% drop in pollutants over the current fuel, and 15% more volumetric energy than 100 low lead. So it's superior all around, and ASTM certified to go into that market as a drop-in replacement. From a jet turbine fuel standpoint, we can make a fuel, and that market is 100 times bigger, by the way, and obviously very interesting to the U.S. Department of Defense. We can make a fuel that is a 100% renewable, sustainable fuel with very similar superior characteristics without the requirement of blending. Right now, all of the other manufacturers that I'm aware of that are working on algae-based fuels for the military will be working on fuels that are 50-50 blended with fossil fuels.
Oh, really?
And we believe we're the only ones that can offer a fuel that is 100% unblended, renewable, sustainable, and algae-based.
Wow. So the other fuels have to be blended with the normal aviation fuels that we have today, 50-50, and what you're coming up with is your fuels will not have to be blended at all. It'll be straight to algae-produced fuel. But now, just without getting me too deep into this, William, can you give me a quick overview as to why there has to be lead added to the current aviation fuels, but there'll be none needed to add to your fuels? Is it because you're more refined, or what is it?
Yes, and the regular fuels require what's called tetraethyl lead, which improves the octane rating. Mm-hmm. It is an additive that just improves the performance of that fuel. And I could go into the chemistry, but I'm not sure this would be the time. But the nice thing about our fuel is without that, our fuel will have an octane rating probably up in the 120s, probably mid-120s. We believe, and it depends on the measurements. Many of the measurements are hard to make in that range.
So your fuel will actually be a very high octane fuel without the necessity of loading it up with lead. Now, do you see then what? You know, there's an awful lot of jet fuel being used out there, and we know that it's really dirty. But how big a bite out of the jet fuel market are you going to be able to make, and how soon can this happen?
Yes, it will take some time. We point out that, and I could talk in the broad view of what can be done and what this technology can do. And let me just point that out, because it's sort of the same idea as how we might approach jet fuel. It's just one of the fuels that we can make. I point out, just from the big perspective, in 2008, we imported 4.7 billion barrels of oil into this country. I think about 65% of our petroleum need. In 2008, that same year, we also farmed 29 million acres of corn and soybean planted solely for biofuels. Mm. And that only produced about 3.2% of the energy that is in that import need, okay. The 4.7 billion.
All right.
So for 29 million acres of corn and soybeans, we produced 3.2% of 4.7 billion barrels. That's a lot of land for not a whole lot of bang, we'll say.
Yeah.
Using our technology for algae production, using only 20 million acres of land ultimately, we could eliminate all foreign imports. So 100% of our foreign oil import need would be eliminated, and we'd produce that 4.7 billion barrels of equivalent petroleum fresh.
And how much land, again, tell me, would you need to, in order to replace all foreign oil? How much land is it?
20 million acres. So we'd give back, even if we used the same land, we'd give back 9 million acres to food. And considering that we don't have to have arable land for this, it should be quite a lot more than that.
All right. Well, let's get back to this facility that you're putting in Indiana, this 2,000 acres that you're going to have enclosed, and you're going to make sure that it's warm in the winter and cool in the summer. But isn't that going to be using, I mean, doesn't that kind of defeat the whole energy thing? Because you got to have energy to do that, and isn't that going to be just as costly to develop the algae as you're really getting from the algae because of those costs?
Well, an energy balance is a very important question, and that's been a question that's been asked very critically of ethanol and biodiesel production over the years.
Sure.
The real question, if you draw the circle wide enough, it really looks like there's more petroleum and more energy used to produce the ethanol than you get out of the ethanol at the end of the process, for instance. In contrast, algae is so productive, since it's about 20 times more productive than corn and soybean biofuel production, the energy balance is actually a lot better and significantly positive. One of the nice things about this, too, and it's important to co-locate and use these other energy sources where they already are. You know, we aren't going to be ending use of coal electricity anytime soon, although, we're certainly looking at all these other sources. But where we can capture the CO2, use the waste heat from power production and other kinds of industrial processes, we can essentially get a twofer, if you can imagine, and recycle CO2 into transport fuels that are still tremendously needed, not to mention all the other uses we put petroleum to.
Okay, yes, I can see. And of course, one of the complaints we do know about biofuels is that it takes fertilizer to grow them, and the fertilizer is made from oil, so petroleum. So, but you're not going to be needing then fertilizer for your algae?
No, we do need fertilizers. There's many of the, you can imagine the proteins and things that are part of these things all need pieces of the fertilizer. However, one of the nice things about that, many of the interesting fertilizers, the sulfurs and phosphates and potassiums and those sorts of things, all remain in the proteins. And so ultimately we can separate those out as a fertilizer. So essentially we put fertilizer in and we get fertilizer out. And so we're somewhat, we're only taking the carbons and hydrogens out, if you will. So although no process is perfectly 100% conservative of an input like that, we're going to be getting an awful lot of what we put in back out, and we can recycle some of it or sell it to replace that cost stream.
Okay, now what's the process? You grow this algae, and you get a fully grown algae, and you're going to tell me in a minute about how long it takes you to go from nothing to algae that's ready for harvesting. But when it's ready for harvesting, what do? Siphon it off and run it through a press and squeeze all the oil out of it, or what's the process there?
Well, it's something like that. Once you think of it, different algaes in different production methods reach different densities. Mm. In a pond, it's very low density. Quarter to half a gram per liter, typically. In our case, it's going to be up, 2 to 3 grams per liter, for instance. And at that rate, our reactors would be very, very dark and just almost black. So what you do, if you think about it, though, there's 1,000 grams in a liter. So 2 to 3 grams out of 1,000, that's still 99.7 or 8% water. So the traditional way that's used to separate the algae is what's called a centrifuge. Well, we have a process that is 100 times less energy requirement than a centrifuge, mm-hmm. and can extract the algae very effectively from the water, and then we recycle the water and put it back into the reactors along with the nutrients that remain. So once we have the algae separated, we actually dry it so that it's very, very dry. At that point, we can use existing industrial processes that are used for oil extraction to extract the oil and process it and the biomass into the other constituent parts that we need. Does that make sense?
That gives me a pretty good picture, Will. So let's pick up from there when we get back from the break after the half hour. Okay, as we walk the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
I come to you from the halls of ancient Greece. Aristotle, student of Plato, speaking English no less. I count him braver who overcomes his desires than him who conquers his enemies. For the hardest victory is over self.